letter is presented by Mr. Abdul Patel. I see that Advocate Lyon is also here. Decided to sit at the back. I don't know. I don't want to get into your politics, but he is here. But we normally allocate 20 minutes for your submission, and after that we'll have a discussion on all three of the submissions: yourselves, the People's Budget Coalition, and IDASA. And we'll proceed as the program then. So without wasting time, your 20 minutes start now. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, Honorable Members of the Committee. I can assure you there's no agenda as to why the advocate sitting in the back bench. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the opportunity to have made oral submission as well as written submissions to the committee on this bill. As members would know, the Business Parliamentary Office is a facility established to facilitate the parliamentary interface and advocacy needs of the organized business sector in South Africa, with a real commitment to contributing very constructively to the deepening of parliamentary democracy itself. And it's within that context that the submission has been made as a genuine and constructive effort to engage with Parliament in co-creating a workable procedure for dealing with amendments to money bills and related matters that the bill refers to. The perspectives put forward by us is put forward in that context, but also in the context of interaction that we've had with the eminent panel of persons appointed by the Honourable Speaker of Parliament last year to undertake the assessment of Parliament in meeting its constitutional mandate, and also work that we do related to the performance of Parliament globally in advancing parliamentary democracy and the interface with civil society, and the types of engagement that we've had with bodies like the Inter-Parliamentary Union, the World Bank Parliamentary Network, and the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association. We believe that the matters contained in our submission, it's important that this committee satisfies itself that these matters are dealt with in dealing with this particular bill. And I'll outline the reasons why. But at the outset, let me say that the Business Parliamentary Office supports the general principle of the proposed legislation to enhance the oversight and role of Parliament in dealing with money bills. So we think this is important given the significance of money bills and the national budget as a tool for enhancing socio-economic development and an expression of what Parliament should represent in terms of the people's needs. Again, at the outset, let me also reaffirm the view that Advocate Abri Meiring, in particular as chairperson of the BPO Advisory Board, has consistently made with regards to the role of this Parliament, particularly since the introduction of the MTBPS in 1996 in upholding very sound principles around fiscal transparency and budget transparency in the way Parliament deals with the national budget. And this is a view that we've upheld consistently in our engagement, not just with this House, but with stakeholders elsewhere in the country and internationally, like the Parliamentary Network or the World Bank. And we think that this is something that needs to be continuously nurtured and cultivated. And it's our view that in many respects it constitutes global good practice, and there are many lessons that can be learned from this. In assessing the provisions of the proposed draft money bill, the main points of departure for ourselves are the following. The first being that there is an imperative for the bill to lend itself to being favorably disposed to contributing further to transparency in the fiscal and budget process, in the way Parliament engages with that process, including amendments to money bills. We also think there's a good case to be made, and I'll elaborate later on, for why this House in dealing with the bill needs to look into the more global experiences around the way parliaments have dealt with amendments to budgetary matters introduced by the executive. And given that this bill deals with the establishment of a parliamentary budget office, also reflect on global experiences and best practices around the establishment of these types of offices and how they've served to not just help parliaments engage with the amendments to money bills and these matters, but also assist parliaments in performing their broader oversight role of the executive and policy and legislation. And lastly, we think that it's important that the bill should strive towards a procedure for the amendment of money bills that's A, predictable, B, proportionate in relation to the overall volume and budget parameters of the national budget and the medium-term economic outlook, that C, is workable in relation to Parliament's schedule and the planning cycle of government, that's practical in relation to the efficiency of spending of government, and which minimizes unintended consequences for the economy. And so we believe that the debate as to whether the bill is necessary or not, clearly that stage is passed. I think the focus should now be on how the House and this committee ensure that the provisions contained in the bill are indeed enabling in terms of the intent of the draft legislation and the oversight work that has informed the development of the legislation, but also enhances the capacity and ability of this Parliament to fulfill its core constitutional mandate in terms of oversight and contributing to national development outcomes. I'd like to turn to some specific comments we make in our written submission now. The first deals with amendments to money bills. And basically we think with the introduction of this bill, we probably will see Parliament experiencing a shift in its role and the way it engages with the national budget. Clearly, up to now, it's been one of a budget-approving role. And clearly, the introduction of this bill will see it also taking on a budget-influencing role. So that's the first point we'd like to note. Two areas that we'd like to point out with regards to the bill, and again, the whole notion of fiscal discipline, is that the bill doesn't seem to elaborate on the provincial and local government implications for the introduction of this bill. Whatever the reasons have been that those are not contained in the bill, we recognize that it's a draft version, but going forward we think it's important that some evidence-based approach is taken into account to inform what the rationale for saying there is implications for provincial or local government or there are none at all. So we think an evidence-based approach is critical just given the intricate system of intergovernmental transfers with regards to the fiscus and the national budget as well as intergovernmental cooperation issues that exist between the three spheres. And then secondly, the question we asked ourselves is whether in undertaking amendments to money bills, whether there would be any minimum or maximum thresholds or ceilings that apply for such amendments in relation to the total volume of the budget that's tabled by the Minister of Finance. The second area I'd like to elaborate on is with regards to the provisions of the bill in the oversight of the committees that are proposed when it comes to macroeconomic policy. Now, our organized business constituency, represented by the preeminent business formations in South Africa, have previously made the iteration to this committee that there is a important consideration that Parliament should give to establishing the institutional home for oversight of macroeconomic policy in South Africa, and in this case, ASGISA. And our view is that the timing for the introduction of this bill, in addition to what it already says about oversight and evaluation of macroeconomic policy, should lend itself to considering how a coherent institutional approach is put in place for the oversight, monitoring, and evaluation of macroeconomic policy in relation to dealing with amendments to money bills, and basically expanding further of what's contained in Section 4, 5, and 6 of the draft bill. And we think this is also important given the interlinked nature of fiscal and macroeconomic policy and the impact it has on national development outcomes as a whole. And then the last area I'd like to pay some attention to is the proposals for the establishment of the Parliamentary Budget Office, and to just pause and reflect on some issues we think are key. The first is really to note that the movement to establish parliamentary or legislative budget offices has been a global trend, and it started more than 50 years ago with the establishment of the Congressional Budget Office in the United States, which is to date the largest of its kind. But clearly this trend has spread vastly to countries in Asia, Latin America, and in Africa, where you will find the Parliamentary Budget Office of the Parliament of Uganda probably provides very valuable lessons in terms of its successes and its challenges to not just our parliament, but other parliaments. We think reflecting on these issues are important because the proliferation of these budget offices have been as a result of various factors, the first being obviously that you have more democracies in the world today than at any other time in history. But secondly, budgets of central governments have grown, they've become more complex, central governments have become stronger, more capacitated, and on a whole there's been more pressures on legislatures and parliaments to exercise more prudent oversight of budgetary issues, and those pressures have also come from outside of the parliamentary realm, civil society, business, the investment community, etc. And then the role played by MPs themselves in relation to budgetary issues have added further pressure. So that's just a broad snapshot of why we think the proliferation has come about, and in the written submissions we just point to a key positive experiences that have yielded results to parliaments, but also some negative instances that clearly need to be managed when these offices are established. But we take the point made in the draft legislation that there is the intent to establish this office, and so in the way we've made our submissions to the committee is to say we think there are probably three or four key areas that this committee should consider when it goes about establishing this office. The first relates to the whole issue of partisanship of such an office, and we would concur with the global body of research into the role of parliamentary budget offices, that these offices need to be non-partisan. Clearly it needs to play a role in providing the same information to all political parties, big and small, and that the notion of being non-partisan means it doesn't undertake its work from a political perspective at all. It's an objective role that it should play. You know, the converse would be if it wasn't non-partisan and it had to play its role from a political viewpoint, then it would be bipartisan. And we would concur with the global body of research that these units need to be objective analytical units that plays a non-partisan role in supporting the parliament and the committees that are established as envisaged by this legislation as a whole. And we think this would also lend more credibility to the process. The next area that relates to characteristic features of a parliamentary budget office is obviously the notion of its work being objective, and clearly the whole notion of objectivity and its partisanship are linked. The most important area we think needs more consideration is the issue of the core functions of a parliamentary budget office, and having observed the deliberations of this committee when it received the first briefing on the bill from the Parliamentary Legal Advisor, our view is that it's not sufficient to leave the core functions of this office to be dealt with at a later point in time. We think the legislation actually needs to spell it out. And there are various reasons why we say so. Firstly, we think it's important because we think codifying it in law would make sure that the functions are firstly aligned with the mandate, which would also be contained in the draft legislation, that it would also make the functions above political interference when you have political change, that by having its functions codified in law also gives real impetus for the ability of this office to support the role of Parliament as the national legislative authority, and therefore the requirements that Parliament would place on this office in supporting the work of Parliament when it comes to to oversight and evaluation of money-related matters and budgetary-related matters. Thirdly, we think that it's important that it's codified in law so that you have a systematic approach to the mandate of the office vis-a-vis its core functions. And it may not be appropriate to leave the core functions to be spelled out through a business planning process and detailed operational and implementation plans. Actually, the view of the Business Parliamentary Office is that the core functions should inform those plans as opposed to the other way around. So we think the whole notion of the institutional design of this office, its institutional architecture, is very, very important for the effectiveness that this office will have in serving the Parliament in the way that it should. And fourthly, we think having its functions put in the draft legislation and codified appropriately is also important, given that it would need to interact with similar offices that exist at the central government level, such as the National Treasury Budget Office, so that it's able to engage the cooperative intergovernmental level on an equal footing in a constructive manner, so that there is not unhealthy tension between the two, and that the flow of information assists Parliament in performing its oversight role effectively. So we think the need for those type of guidelines within the law as it relates to the functions of the office is absolutely critical. I'm not going to get into the detail, but we have listed in our submission at least six key functions that we think this office should perform. They relate to economic forecasting, analysis of the budget proposals tabled by the executive, medium to long-term analysis, which we think is particularly important given the changing nature of both democracy and society at large, and the trends that that will have and the impact that that will have on national budgetary issues. Also, we think it needs to play a role in analyzing proposals made by MPs in the legislature with regards to policies and programs that impact on budgetary affairs. And clearly, there are many of these proposals that are made by MPs throughout the financial year, and perhaps it would be useful if this office also lends itself to evaluating those constructive proposals and value-adding proposals made by MPs and beginning to look at the costing for them in terms of how they could be incorporated into national delivery programs. Clearly, there need to be a criteria for doing that effectively. And then, obviously, we've seen the whole issue of regulatory impact assessments with regards to legislation and regulations that support legislation in recent years. And do we think it's important that this office has some focus on that in supporting Parliament when it deals with legislation that has regulatory impacts on a wide scale, impacting both on the economy but also regulators and civil society at large? Clearly, the office would have a role in primarily supporting the budget committees that are put forward in the proposed legislation, and we think this is right. But we also think the office, if it's to be effective in serving Parliament in the way that it should also be able to interface with civil society stakeholders that have an active interest in Parliament's oversight of the budget. And we think being favorably disposed towards this would contribute further to vibrant parliamentary democracy around the budget, as this committee and the Joint Budget Committee has consistently upheld since 1996. Turning to the issue of capacity, resourcefulness, and staffing of the Parliamentary Budget Office, clearly these things are impacted upon by the resources that would be available to this office, and we don't want to delve too much into that, but to say that the frequency of services will be dependent on that resourcefulness, but also the mix of skill and competency that is in this office. And we think that needs careful consideration so that the office is competent enough to meet the demands placed on it by Parliament in performing its functions. And we've listed about 7 or 8 key areas that range from competencies in the area of macroeconomic and development economics to data analysis, fiscal policy, tax policy, and public financial management and constitutional law that should reside in that office. With regards to capacity, We've identified two key areas that we think just needs consideration. The first is the whole notion of capacity utilization of this office versus capacity building of the office, where capacity utilization relates to making sure that the office is used for the purposes that it's been set out in the legislation to do and not misused or underutilized. So once again, reinforcing that codifying the core functions of the office in the legislation is key. The issue of capacity building, we think, is important given, as I said in the introduction, that you've seen this groundswell of the establishment of these offices globally. And we think they're valuable experiences that can be garnered through this parliament sharing knowledge exchange and information with other parliaments, be they on the African continent, such as the Ugandan parliament or elsewhere, who have established these offices, so that the best practices can be understood, the lessons can be learned, and where there are opportunities for cooperation across boundaries, those can be established, but also so that Parliament can tap into funding and resources that are available, particularly in the global community, to support this type of capacity building exercise. I've outlined in the written submission, Chairperson, just two institutional issues. The one relates to the budget committees that are proposed, and I don't see any problem with them. The only recommendation or consideration we'd like to make to the committee with regards to those two committees is the whole issue of exploring whether the chairpersons of portfolio committees in Parliament and select committees in the NCOP would have the ability to participate in those budget committees as ex officio members, in the sense that we think perhaps that would assist the cross flow of information to those budget committees when those budget committees consider issues of amendments to money bills and the types of recommendations that they will make with regards to money bills. Also, given that portfolio committees and select committees are often a lot closer to the nature of the departmental level issues that underpin line items in the budget. And the other issue that we identified is what we think is the whole notion of institutional memory, because as I said in the introduction, this Parliament, we believe, has played a sterling role in the whole approach to an open ethos oversight of the national budget in Parliament and civil society engagement with that parliamentary process, and we think in enacting this legislation there are valuable lessons that can be learned from the experiences since 1996, and we think perhaps the introduction of this legislation is also time for just a quick review, so that we're not just introducing new aspects with this legislation, but we're drawing on the best of practices that this Parliament has upheld over the period that has passed. Chairperson, those are all the comments that we think are key, and I've just extrapolated them from the written submission. But we again endorse the principle of this legislation in terms of its ability to strengthen the oversight role of Parliament and help Parliament strengthen parliamentary democracy even further. And I think our only request is that where this leads to further revisions of the draft bill and reiterations of the draft bill, that perhaps there's also a further opportunity for the public to engage with those bills through this committee, as has been done with the first draft. So thank you very much. If there are any particular questions, I'll try to answer them. But the written submission is there, and I think there are a number of detailed points in the submission. So thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Patel. As I did indicate, we'll take questions, we'll have discussions after all three submissions. If members could just note their questions. If you could just, you can remain there, and we'll have the next submission from the program says it'll be the People's Budget Coalition. May request the People's Budget Coalition to come to the front. Mr. Patel, if you, maybe we must just move to the side, but you don't have to leave that area. just allow space for the coalition to sit, because after them and Idasa, we will then take a take discussion. Whilst they are coming forward, I'm informed that they are represented by Mr. Mfanafuthi Sela from Kusatu and Ms. Wendy Neft from Sangoko, and Reverend Keith Mullen from the South African Council of Churches, and Mr. Sidney Khara, Nehao Parliamentary Officer. This side, this side, please. Welcome, gentlemen and the lady. We have given you 20 minutes for your to talk to your submission, which we just received a few minutes ago. And your 20 minutes start now. Thank you.
Is this on? Is that on? Thank you for the introductions, and may I just reiterate that we represent the People's Budget Coalition. My name is Keith Vermeulen, South African Council of Churches, which is one stakeholder in the People's Budget Campaign. Next to me is Mr. Fanafuthi Tsela from the Congress of South African Trade Unions Parliamentary Office. Next to him is Mr. Sidney Khara, the Nehao Parliamentary Office. And on my right is Mrs. Wendy Neft, who represents the National Treasurer of Sangoko. So we are complete in presence of the People's Budget Campaign as we present this proposal submission to you. Just to remind the House of those who may not know, that the People's Budget Campaign is a coalition of the South African Council of Churches, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, and the South African NGO Coalition. The People's Budget Campaign seeks to define fiscal strategies that can eradicate poverty, support economic development, ensure greater equity by race, class and gender, through the meeting of basic needs, especially restoring and enhancing the public sector and social spending, ensuring the retention and creation of quality jobs in the context of economic growth, giving the majority of people greater access to assets and skills, supports increasingly democratic and participatory governance, and protection of the environment, ensuring sustainable development throughout the Southern Africa region. I remind the gathering here that the reason People's Budget was formed was in response to the 1997 tabling of the amendment bill, the money bills amendment legislation at that stage, which led the General Secretary of the COSATU to explain the position of frustration of civil society with which the stakeholders, Council of Churches, Sangoko, and of course COSATU agreed when he said that we will only participate in future parliamentary budget hearings if meaningful participation is made through a reformed budget process. And so mindful of our common responsibility to ensure that the budget process is transformed in line with our commitment to democratic, transparent governance and the constitutional mandate in Section 77 of our Constitution, I need to ask you to recall that the People's Budget Campaign, Council of Churches and Gorko, and the FACC welcomes this opportunity and thanks you for the ability to comment and make submission on the draft money bill procedure and related matters 2008. The People's Budget Campaign stakeholders trust that the proposed legislation will provide for a significant attention to budget and economic transformation that incorporates, and this is perhaps our bottom line, that incorporates civil and public participation so as to stimulate the People's Budget Campaign stakeholders' right to engage Parliament in a reformed budget process in the near future. In terms of amendment powers, Parliament, People's Budget Campaign has in its proposals as early as 2003, sir, in fact, 2002, in its 2003-2004 document, recommended that the amendment powers of Parliament as they relate to budget reform processes, the transformation of the economy, indeed even towards a proper budget and anti-poverty strategy, that these are inherently linked to a process that is inclusive of civil and public participation. And so we affirm the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, Section 77, which is unlike any process, obviously, that was available during the era of apartheid, where no one in public and no civil society could have any interaction with the development of Moneyball's legislation. And we are simply echoing the call that up until now, while we have not had the implementation of the amendment rights, that this is a welcome opportunity. However, while we welcome the recognition of the scope and timing of the proposed amendments, we lament its lateness, and we want to just underline the people's budget's decision at presenting the proposal before us. We recognise that the scope and timing of parliamentary amendment powers is one of the most contentious debates around which budget reform revolves. Those that emphasise budgetary stability and the importance of technical management of the budget are inclined to want to limit Parliament's capacity to alter the executive budget. Now, proposed budget stability point out that the budget process is technically complex. Now, question whether parliamentarians have the capacity to assess the impact that changes in one vote will have on programs of another department. In contrast, others argue that one of the fundamental functions of government is the collection and allocation of public funds. Other policy decisions are meaningless if there are insufficient resources to realize the stated objectives. This camp would argue that the legislature must exercise budgetary and financial powers, commensurate with its legislative and policy-making powers. This implies that Parliament must be able to make fairly substantial changes in the budget, including changes to public spending, changes that have unavoidable implications for macroeconomic policy. Our presentations adopt a middle course between these two extremes. On the one hand, we acknowledge the legitimacy of technocrats' interest in a fairly stable and efficient budgeting process, which is not prone to being held hostage to political or other special interests of the legislature, technically referred to as poor balloting those who have interests of the department through the budget. On the other hand, the people's budget agrees that the Parliament must be able to exert substantial influence on spending priorities if there's to be meaningful democratic control over the deployment of public resources. So in this regard, so we welcome what's happening with the draft money bill, and we signify the people's budget campaign that Parliament should have the ability to amend the budget. However, in the way forward, the presentation will take us through the proposed bill with some of our concerns, and Mr. Sarah will do that for us, and we will conclude with a section on the importance of public and civil society participation, which Mr. Neft will take us through.
Thank you, Chairperson and honourable members. In fact, our concern, I think, on the definition section, we think that on the fiscal framework section, we think there is lack of clarity of what constitutes a fiscal framework. Key issues that Parliament is required, as per Clause 6, Subsection 1, to consider, adapt, and which may set the parameters for Parliament's subsequent amendment of money bills. This point, however, is not clearly spelled out in the bill. What constitutes fiscal framework? Because this goes to the heart of how far Parliament can actually amend money bills. The definition provides for the fiscal framework. The relevant fiscal framework, as reflected in the national macroeconomic policy, is very vague. We are not sure whether it refers to the key fiscal aggregates such as the deficit, GDP ratio, or the expenditure, GDP ratio, or something far more detailed. A clear working definition should provide either the definition, should provide it either in the definition section or in section 5. When it comes to the money bills, the term money bills cover broadly two categories of bills. First, bills that are associated with the national budget process. That is, bills that appropriate from the National Revenue Fund, and bills of taxation. The national budget process as a primary mechanism for delivery of government programs may be subject to practical constraints, especially related to the question of time. Accordingly, as part of the civil society, we believe that the provision must be made for a meaningful role of civil society participation in the budget process. We accept, however, that the budgetary process will not necessarily mirror other bills, like, for instance, money bills or ordinary bills. While we admit that there are particular time constraints applicable to budget bills, it will be problematic to apply the same principle of bills to bills of taxation, which, if necessary, will be held over for more longer parliamentary consideration when necessary. Therefore, the public participation process should mirror that of other ordinary non-monetary bills. Because Section 77, subsection 3 of the Constitution provides that all money bills must be considered in accordance with the procedure established by Section 75, which should be an indication that the Constitution does not envisage a process that is completely different from that of ordinary non-money bills. Then our other concern is on the parliamentary committees for consideration of the proposed amendments. Like in the bill, there is no rationale that provides for the establishment of these new committees and the role and what role existing committees will play in relation, if any, in relation to these committees. How will these committees of parliament to be established in terms of this bill, and how they relate with the current work of the Portfolio Committee, for instance, in Finance, the Select Committee on Finance, and the Joint Budget Committee, for example. The proposed committees will require to deal with issues such as consideration of the national government fiscal policy framework and macroeconomic policy, and the consideration of national public finances. If Parliament is to fully engage the budget issues, there must be a shift on emphasis in terms of allocation of time for the debate in the House for deliberation in the committees. All portfolio committees, not just the finance, will need to be more actively involved in the budget process rather than leaving the primary responsibility of budget to the Finance and Public Accounts Committee. The People's Budget Campaign, therefore, recommends greater clarity as to how these committees are intended to relate with existing committees. When it comes to Section 5, the section specifies that statements on government fiscal policy and macroeconomic policy, intergovernmental financial and fiscal relations, and the medium-term budget policy statement must be provided to Parliament at least 3 months before the introduction of the national legislation that appropriates money. During this time, Parliament needs to receive these important pieces of legislation and information and consider them, hold public hearings, and make necessary communication with Treasury so that the views of Parliament can be incorporated in the preparation of the budget. this time period appears insufficient. By the time Parliament makes its views known, it may be likely that the budget will already have been drawn up. This may have the effect of undermining engagement with the budget process. Furthermore, the bill requires that Parliament to adopt the fiscal framework. This makes no provision in event that Parliament may decide to amend it. The process described in Clause 5, Subsection 1, suggests that the Minister must submit to Parliament statement on the National Government's fiscal policy statement. Our proposal is that the time period considered should be lengthened so that Parliament can engage with the relevant policies well before the preparation of ensuing year's budget. We also propose that the bill provide for a process in which Parliament communicates its views on the information specified in Section 5 to the National Treasurer. Such a process will provide for real engagement rather than a one-way passage of information to enable Parliament to engage in a meaningful participation around fiscal process. Such a process will enable improved participation, enhance stability as well as greater policy predictability, since inputs will be able to flow from Parliament at an earlier stage. We also propose In fact, the bill specifies the committee follow a consultation process concerning information required prior to introduction of national budget and fiscal framework which Parliament is required to adopt. This means that the consultation proposed in both is both a constitutional and a democratic imperative in order to enhance Parliament's role of oversight. Therefore, we further recommend that this bill should be amended to provide for public hearings on issues specified in Section 5 prior to the adoption of the fiscal framework by Parliament. The National Government Fiscal Framework and Macroeconomic Policy, that is on Section 6. Section 6 suggests that Parliament may amend money bills once it has been adopted. It has adopted the fiscal policy framework and the national and the annual division of revenue bill. Greater clarity is required on how to link these events. What are the consequences if Parliament disagrees with the fiscal policy framework? What may be the implications should the fiscal policy framework about which Parliament may have reservations be adopted? And how will Parliament relate to subsequent amendments to the budget? Greater clarity of the procedure is required, because I would assume that if the macroeconomic framework or the fiscal framework is going to come from Parliament, it's going to come from the National Treasurer, the parliamentarians may disagree with it. It's more likely, because if you can look at the current fiscal framework, it does not take into consideration some of the developmental challenges which the country is facing, and I assume that parliamentarians can want to interrogate that, and it's possible that they can reject it. So we feel that the bill does not provide greater clarity on how to deal with such a situation. On the procedure for amending money bills in Section 7, Clause 3, Subsection 3, Clause 7, Subsection 3 requires that any committee proposing an amendment to a money bill must motivate for such proposal with reference to the following items and proceeds to list 11 items, A to K. It is not clear whether it is intended to mean that the proposal needs to be motivated with reference to all of the items or any of them. We assume that it is the latter, since it should be unreasonable to expect Parliament to motivate any proposal with reference to all 11. Therefore, we propose the list under Section 7, Subsection 3, to be broadened to include the constitutional obligations imposed on government ensuring access to all, to housing, to healthcare, food, water, social security, care and protection of children, the environment that promotes health and well-being, and education that provides for economic well-being of the nation. The above proposal is based on the consideration that Parliament, in fulfilling its constitutional function of passing a mandatory amendment, mandatory amending money bill procedure, to acknowledge its responsibility to allow government to fulfill its constitutionally enshrined responsibilities in providing for the people's socio-economic rights and needs. Such recognition would have implications for Section 7, subsection 7, which refers to the items which a committee needs to make to take into account when considering a report relating to the proposed amendments to a money bill. And for Section 7, subsection 6, which specifies that the committee must provide for the House to the House its reasons for a proposed amendment. Both of these clauses cross-reference Section 7, subsection 3. Then on the establishment of the budget office, we propose that the mandate of this office be somewhat broadened from that specified, in line with the responsibilities and areas of work proposed in the bill for the new committees. Section 4 specifies that the new committee deals with issues such as government's fiscal policy framework and macroeconomic policy, yet the areas of work specified in the budget office in Section 8 is somewhat narrow. Detailed administrative support, which is to include research and technical aspects in the areas of public finance. Although this section does not exclude other areas of work for the budget office, it de-emphasizes them by omission. This might mean that the budget office does not provide the necessary support for committees in other relevant areas of their work, such as macroeconomic policy. We therefore propose a broader section 8, subsection 3, to read section 8, subsection 3, that the dedicated administrative support must provide research, technical experts in the area of public finance and macroeconomic policy. The People's Budget Campaign further recognized that Parliament will require enhanced research and analytical capacity if it is to exercise its budgetary amendment powers responsibly and effectively, and that while Parliament itself is best placed to determine what form this increased capacity will take, the following points are relevant. Expert capacity will be particularly essential in areas such as macroeconomic analysis and modelling, analysis of spending and identification of obstacles to spending, and accurate cost of alternative proposal in both the expenditure and revenue side. The proposed budget office should be an appropriate institutional mechanism to provide Parliament, the finance and budget committees in particular, with the necessary backup. Other portfolio committees should also have access to specialized budgetary research and analysis, e.g. in health, economics, transport economics, etc. Agrees with research conducted in 2002 that 5 to 8% increase in budget in Parliament's budget would build a good skeleton service. I think Comrade Wendy is going to go to further consideration.
Yeah, I hate doing this, but I don't want us to be unfair to other presenters. When I allocate 20 minutes, I really mean it, Comrade. Right. Go ahead. We've already gone into other people's time. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The People's Budget Campaign would like to present two opportunities for broader engagement. First of all, we believe that the bill is silent on any form of public or civic participation, and therefore unclear in its relation to budget reform, economic transformation, and the constitutional instruction to include democratic participation in the procedure for amending money rolls. The People's Budget Campaign therefore proposes the following opportunities. Firstly, MEDLAC. MEDLAC should be able to engage substantively with the budget process in a way which complements the role of elected representatives. The Public Finance and Monetary Chamber of MEDLAC should engage with the budget throughout the cycle and should be able to deal with all 3 years of the Medlington budget planning statement. MEDLAC should be involved in all important aspects of the medium-term budget and specific sites of intervention in the budget cycle, and could include the following points. Prior to the presentation of the draft medium-term budget, the Department of Finance could present its macroeconomic projections for the next 3 years to MEDLAC. MEDLAC or its constituencies could mandate independent analysis and projections, and there could be engagement within the chamber around what projections are realistic and or desirable, with an emphasis on the coming year. Secondly, the medium-term budget could be tabled at MEDLAC. Constituencies would then table input focusing on macroeconomic parameters. The onus would be on the Department of Finance to accommodate these. The intention would be to negotiate constituencies' positions to reach, if not consensus, then agreement on the bands within which key parameters should fall. Such agreements would then inform the final MTBPC. The final MTBPC would then be tabled at MEDLAC. As in its presentation to Parliament, the Department could be required to indicate to what extent it has incorporated agreements, constituency proposals, and if not, why not. After the presentation of the budget, constituencies could table the inputs to MEDLAC. Constituency proposals would then be forwarded to the relevant portfolio committees and the budget committee to inform their deliberations. At some point during the budget cycle, MEDLAC could also address itself to significant definitional issues. For example, the classification of personnel versus current expenditure, or the definition of the deficit, and propose more appropriate standards of measurements and presentation. MEDLAC's role should be explicitly spelled out in the Moneyball Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, so that it can exercise its democratic mandate as an instrument of popular sovereignty. Parliament must have adequate and appropriate research and analysis capacity to enable it to use its power effectively. Therefore, opportunities for input, both public and parliamentary, must be introduced throughout the budget cycle. They should not be confined to the final stages, when substantial changes become difficult to incorporate without causing serious disruption. Secondly, civil society. In the medium to long term, opportunities should be created for the structured participation of civil society in the budget process along the lines of poverty hearings. All those of civil society, as well as individual community members, have valuable inputs to make in terms of their needs, expenditure priorities, and problems in current programs. This information would not only improve the quality of the budget, but give people a sense of ownership of the budget. Interaction could take the form of hearings on particular functions in particular provinces on an annually rotating basis. And the following year, each province would deal with a different function. In the short term, there would be two main ways that civil society organizations could influence the budget process if the People's Budget Campaign's proposals are adopted. Firstly, they would be able to make submissions to Parliament itself at the various stages of the budget cycle. Once Parliament has meaningful amendment powers, this would become a worthwhile process. Secondly, there would be opportunities for input through MEDLAC. The youth, rural, disabled and women sectors that currently sit only in the Development Chamber should also be invited to participate in budget deliberations in the Public Finance and Monetary Chamber. Mr. Chair, in conclusion, The People's Budget Campaign welcomes, even at this late stage, the introduction of this piece of legislation that deals with Parliament's constitutional mandate to provide an Act of Parliament providing for a procedure to amend money bills before Parliament. We realize that Parliament, as with many other, are working under tight time constraints. We have outlined the People's Budget Campaign close affinity for budget reform, the transformation of the economy and democratic control of the allocation of public resources. We have further raised our concerns at what we believe are shortcomings within the bill, but we have simultaneously offered proposals in line with the history of research of the campaign on budget reform and money bills amendment procedure legislation. We believe that within all civil society and labour as represented within the People's Budget Campaign, there should exist goodwill, resource and capacity to engage Parliament for legislation in the best sense of strengthening our participatory and constitutional democracy. To this end, we believe that without the participation of civil society, this bill will, however, be fundamentally flawed. We look forward to further engagement with Parliament, as might be necessary on this matter, in the hope that this constitutional requirement for economic transformation may be recognised and implemented in a manner best befitting our maturing constitutional democracy. Mr. Chairman, I thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. The next submission is by Idasa. Can I request that Idasa comes forward? I'm no longer going to introduce all of you. I'm going to introduce Mr. Lanfervey, and if he wishes to introduce the rest of the team, he can do so, because I find presenters are tempted to continue to introduce themselves even though I have introduced who they are, and they eat into their time by doing so. Mr. Fervey.
Good morning, Mr. Chairperson, honourable members of the committee. It's Lanfervey from IDASA. I have brought a number of my colleagues, but I'm going to be sitting here all by myself. Thank you again for this opportunity. IDASA has also made a written submission, which I trust that members have received, and my remarks will flow from that written submission. I think I'm going to start very briefly with some broad remarks, but the substance of what I would like to say consists of some fairly detailed remarks on specific aspects of the legislation, what we regard as omissions, concerns. So in a way, I'm not apologizing, but saying ahead of time that I think I will like to focus on some of the detailed aspects of it in my this discussion. IDASA believes it's very important that we have this legislation. It's been a long time coming. And really, though, we feel that the devil is in the detail. The framework established by the legislation, we believe, will largely determine the quality of Parliament's engagement and whether that engagement, in fact, contributes to improved budget outcomes, or, in fact, takes us down. We know what some of the risks are in a global context of a poor legislative engagement with budgeting. Those include so-called fiscal profligacy. We have the risk of amendment overload, where as an institution, Parliament simply can't cope with the amendment demands placed on it. And some of the other submissions have spoken of some other potential risks as well. So by all those risks in mind, we feel the legislation does need to address that. We also feel that some of those issues are not adequately captured in the draft bill, but are in a sense shifted perhaps towards the idea that they may be covered in some future standing rules. But we feel that a lot of the issues are too important to not least get the sense in this legislation of what the thinking is. The first, going into some of the detail in this regard, the first issue we have, and I think the CBAN's other submissions, they've also been covered by both of them, is around vagueness to do with what might be meant with a fiscal framework. In our understanding, there are fundamentally two approaches one can take as to what that phrase might mean. One can see it as being, in some sense, a rule-based approach to fiscal governance. And all of us here will be familiar with the European Union's use of specific, explicit, quantitative rules governing fiscal behavior in relation to the deficit, the debt stock as a percentage of GDP. So that's one sense in which a fiscal framework that might mean something, which is not what we have in South Africa, as all of us here know. In South Africa, at the moment, we have a transparency, discretionary-based system where the executive is largely accountable for results, understood broadly. It's not held accountable specifically for a deficit target, for example. So the question is, when we say that Parliament would approve a fiscal framework, clearly it would be easier for Parliament to approve some kind of quantitative target. But that's not where we're at in terms of how we understand fiscal governance in South Africa. And the last part was that Parliament really just ends up approving or engaging with a very vaguely formulated commitment, let's say, to fiscal prudence, which is what we have at the moment anyway. There's nothing wrong with that. But I definitely need more clarity on what we mean and what Parliament would then be approving. Because I feel like essentially that this, in a sense, sweeps under the carpet the more pressing issue of what exactly, how do we envision the scope of amendment power, specifically its macroeconomic aspect. And I think that issue, which we know is a significant one, isn't adequately covered by referring to a fiscal framework. That's the first concern we have, which is it's a fairly general one. I don't believe that the legislation as it stands provides a very clear sense of what is meant by amendment and how it is to be understood. And specifically as relates to what its macroeconomic aspects might be. And there are so many different options with different implications that we feel this has to, not necessarily in detail, but the legislation has to indicate something of what it understands by this. To give you some examples, are we saying that Parliament may take away from a department, let's say 5% of its allocation, but then it has to let me put it the other way around. Are we saying Parliament can increase an allocation by, say, 5%? But must then reduce some other allocation by 5%? Are we saying that Parliament may increase allocations without doing that, in which case we have a larger deficit? Are we saying, what exactly are the constraints here? In my written submission, I listed some options. I'd just like to, with your permission, read some of them. Amendments might mean reallocation between votes without constraints, as long as aggregates are not affected. That's an option. It may, however, also mean that it may not exceed a specific percentage. And in some of the other submissions, that comment was also made. Is there a threshold to how much we can take away or add? Are we saying that we may reallocate as long as the budget balance is not altered? In other words, as long as, in a sense, fiscal policy remains similar? May Parliament then increase taxes in order to retain a similar budget balance if it wants to, if it wants spending to increase? Another option is, are we saying, for example, Parliament may in fact make these decisions as long as over a business cycle the net impact is more or less a budget balance, which is also an option? Or are we saying, in fact, that this amendment power is entirely unconstrained? Or in the sense that it needs to be determined and put in the standing rules at some later date. So we're not saying that all of this needs to be clarified now, but there is no sense in the legislation of what the thinking on these issues is. There's no set, as far as we can determine, no clear statement of principle that would guide further discussion within this institution on these questions either. So that we regard as probably the most serious omission, if I can call it that. Right. A third concern is the issue of a budget committee. It's a very brief comment, and it's just to point out that there are probably specific advantages to having a specific budget committee, but of course we have the finance committee, we have the joint budget committee, and we're not sure having a third committee is administratively going to be the most efficient way of organizing Parliament's amendment engagement with the budget. The very background, it seems, however, to potentially just to lead to a very cumbersome administrative structure, and it may be more advisable to look at changing the, let's say, the strategic vision of either the Joint Budget Committee and or the Finance Committee. All right, very briefly. Another point, there are just 5 points in total, so if you'll bear with me. The fourth point is on the information that needs to be submitted by the Minister of Finance and some issues around that. We have no problem with Section 5 in terms of what is required. Of course, most of that information is really provided in the medium-term budget policy statement, as you will know, which does come out an adequate length of time before the budget, and in that sense already facilitates participation by Parliament. So I don't think that's a new requirement, and we just emphasize that any meaningful engagement in the future is not going to be primarily necessarily even determined by amendment legislation, because the medium-term budget policy statement and the related documents already constitute a very significant opportunity to engage with the budget. So Parliament will have to continue using those. Most of those requirements of Section 5, such as a statement on the national government's fiscal policy framework, intergovernmental relations, are covered. The one additional one which makes this a bit of a beefed up NTBPS requirement perhaps is that a kind of a draft budget. But as members will know as well, what is of strategic interest in the NTBPS is these additional top-up. A lot of the budget is not discretionary anyway, as you know. So what we are interested in is just the additional allocations, which from a perspective of this institution's interaction with the budget is quite adequately provided in the NTBPS, in our opinion, anyway. All right. So it might be that the existence of formal amendment power gives Parliament a lot more clout in its engagement there. But this isn't really asking for something which is not already provided, in our opinion. The last part actually flows from that, which is the issue of time frames. The draft bill gives Parliament 4 months to go through the amendment process. If at the end of that it isn't finalized, then the original budget as provided by the Minister of Finance prevails, if you like. And I think there have been some comments already that may not be enough time. But our sense, again, is that Parliament needs to, even in its amendment-related engagement, take a medium-term approach, which specifically means not focusing too much on trying to complete amendments. You know, the budget comes out in February, and rather to take a medium-term approach, to use the fact that it will now have formal amendment power as a kind of way of getting more authority in terms of medium-term budgeting. So when this year's budget comes out, not necessarily to think as much about amending it, but to say these are the concerns we have, and then to ensure that the executive does incorporate them in the NTBPS process. Because we still feel that is probably the most significant way of shaping budget policy, rather than trying within a 4 month period to negotiate an institutionally complex process. That I think is likely to be more tinkering at the margins of the issue. But of course the fact that Parliament has the amendment power is a kind of a final authority that it does have if it feels that the executive is not adequately taking its concerns into account in the budget that it does provide. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairperson, members.
Thank you. Thanks, sir. Yeah, we're back within time again. Thank you. I now open this for discussion. Members can either ask questions of clarity to the first presentation by BPO or the People's Budget Coalition, or it doesn't. I have Mr. Mlotto's hand to Ms. Hogan. The setup here is not very... Mr. Marais, Mr. Mgoni. Have you got them down? Yeah. Mr. Mlotto.
Thank you, Chair. My first question is to Edith Biduasa. I've gone through your presentation last night, and it complicates our work, but in a very good way. I mean, you raised very, very critical points. But I just want to establish something from you. You were talking about a rules-based system in the European Union. Now, I want to refer to the macroeconomic policy convergence project of South Africa that it has entered with SADC. There are certain targets that they aspire to achieve. Now, I mean, it might be a bit of a complex question to you, but I just want to establish, which to me sounds more like a rules-based approach. How would that arrangement then impact on our powers to amend money bills? The second question would be to BPO. You have posed a very interesting question. I'm sorry, I'm a bit disorganized. You have posed a very interesting question on whether, okay, yes, I found it on page 4. You say whether there will be any minimum and maximum threshold ceilings that apply to budgetary amendments. Obviously, you have given a lot of thought to this question. Can you assist us by proposing certain amendments or attempt to give answers to this complex issue?
Thank you. Ms. Hogan.
Chair, could I just hear the response about SADC before I continue? Could I just hear the response, the answer on SADC before I continue, because it's relevant to the question that I might want to pose then.
Oh, is it related to that?
Yeah. Could I hear that response?
Oh, okay. But let's do that. Let's respond to Mr. Mloto's question on this economic convergence quickly.
Thank you. I'm not an expert on SADC and these aspects of it. I think the main point is if SADC convergence criteria mean that South Africa moves to a more rigidly understood rules-based system for fiscal management, I think it would be bad for fiscal governance. We would lose a lot of flexibility, which I think we've demonstrated that we've been able to use quite well. From the perspective of this institution, it might make your work slightly easier. So purely on that level, it would be desirable almost, but I don't think it would be a desirable trend for other reasons. It just meant really sacrificing the flexibility that thus far we've used well.
Then just following on that, to Edith and to any other participant here, I'm not sure if it still holds in New Zealand, but at the time when I was looking at amending money bills, New Zealand had almost two approaches. One, it had a fiscal, I forget what you call it, a fiscal prudence or fiscal policy act, responsibility act itself, which was separated from the budget process as a whole. And a new government was coming to being and it would pass a fiscal policy act and therefore that would be the broad parameters of fiscal policy that would be adopted. The budget process then would then be the fiscal policy framework would then be judged against that fiscal policy. And it might be quantitative and it might be qualitative as well. I'd just like to hear your response on that kind of approach. And if that is so, whether one would want to say that a government should be able to table a fiscal policy framework specifying its length of application and not make it a rigid thing that it has to be part of every budget process. Okay. That would be the one. Listening to the Business Parliamentary Office, and this also applies to the People's Budget people as well. One institution which I think we have really overlooked and which, in my personal opinion, really needs beefing up, but it's a constitutional and institutional body called the Finance and Fiscal Commission. And what role is it playing here? Because we're wanting to shift everything onto the Budget Office,
And we're not envisaging what role the FFC could be playing, because in the Constitution it says that the FFC reports to Parliament. Surely there'd be some facility for Parliament to requisition certain support from the FFC itself, and what would be the differences between a Parliamentary Budget Office and the role that the FFC would play. What is absent, and what I think is a crucial omission from everybody's submissions here at the moment, is the role of the NCOP. We're setting up two budget committees, and we can argue why one needs a budget committee and whatever, but to me what is very unclear in this process is at the moment the NCOP has defined a very important role for itself in terms of the budget process. But at the moment, we're making the NCOP House Committee and the NA House Committee virtual mirror images of each other. And that concerns me, and I'd like to know if there's anything there. Then, just finally, on the medium-term budget policy statement, obviously the Act, the purpose of the Act in a way is the attempt that it's put forward, is to say, look forward, not backwards. Look backwards to look at how a department has performed in terms of delivery. So one of the requirements when you're looking at amending is to look at performance, and that would be reviewed by portfolio committees when they look at the annual reports. So one would have to take into account the performance of a document of a department before you recommend an amendment. But it also recommends that you look at what SCOPA says about a department. So it's very oriented to looking at service deliverables, not just aspirations of what you would like to achieve, and that is looking back. Looking forward, your argument is that the MTBPS is sufficient in itself. I would like to take issue with that. If you look at the MTBPS documents, they're remarkably thin on detail. If you're asking portfolio committees, to influence a budget process ahead of time, not, I stress, to engage in discussion, to get agreement with Treasury or their department, but merely to state what they would prefer to see coming up. The MTBPS is not an appropriate vehicle for that because it's too thin on detail. One would hopefully say, and one would then have to talk to National Treasury as how you get the timing right, that a portfolio committee would almost make a statement, probably when it does its annual report, its review of the annual performance of a department, that it would then include certain things that it would require, certain deficiencies, and if they have fiscal implications, financial implications, that would go to National Treasury. So National Treasury knows what the department is thinking, or what the portfolio committee is thinking, and it's giving a warning of the issues that it might want to take up at a later time. So, I think the timing goes before the MTBPS. Or, when we're dealing with the annual reports, so that's a critical question. And then the budget officer's job is to pull in what SCOPA is saying, what their researchers are saying around performance of a government department, and putting that into a comprehensive statement, which National Treasury and Cabinet must then take into consideration when they're doing the final details.
Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Chair. Just one question to the BPO. You have indicated specifically on that page 3 basic characteristics that you would like to see in this bill, and that it must strive to how to deal with amendments of money bills. Can you maybe just elaborate on those A to F that you have mentioned there as characteristics, and also, what would be the dangers of if that is not done appropriately? In other words, I just want to get behind your message that you want to bring across. Then my second question is to the BBC, the People's Budget Campaign Group. And that's specifically on NetLAC. I get the impression from this proposal that you basically proposing a enshrined position status for NetLAC in this whole process. And I just want to hear from you, through the public participation processes, wouldn't submissions from NetLAC be adequately addressed there? Or how do you really see the nature of the relationship then between NetLAC and specifically this process and this committee going forward? Thank you, sir.
And the last, Mr. Mgune.
Thanks, Chair. My question is in relation with the minimum negligible threshold that we mentioned by PPO. Honourable Lotto has asked me, has already asked part of the question. My question was that to the PPO, whether what the normal practice in other countries that have got powers to amend the budget. If you can give us some examples and how do they amend their bills. And in relation to that, to the People's Campaign, on page 7, the last paragraph, the second paragraph, the last sentence there, you're saying that you recommend that bill must the bill be amended to provide public hearings on issues specified in Section 5 prior adoption of the fiscal framework by Parliament. Now, are you saying that Parliament must disregard what the country can afford? Because again, on page 9, on NetLAC, on page 10 on civil society, we are saying that the Parliament must have public hearings where even individuals can make those presentations, which in my view, that's going to actually raise the hopes of ordinary people, whereas the Parliament might not be able, or government might not be able to meet whatever ordinary people propose on the ground, which just raise expectations, and that we know we won't be able to afford it. I just know what to comment on that. And lastly, if NetLAC, as you insist that it must be in the bill, must be emphasized that it must be part of the process throughout the cycle and in the budget, won't that be a duplication if you go out to do public hearings? Because as you are here, you represent part of the civil society and part of the interest group. Now you go back again and do a public hearings, is that not a duplication?
Thank you. In the remaining few minutes, can I request that you respond in the same order that you presented, starting with the BPO?
Thank you, Chairperson. To Honourable Moloto's question regarding minimum and maximum thresholds, and I'll deal with it through you, Chair, if it's fine, together with Honourable Mkuni's question, because I think they are linked. I think, quite correctly, we put it as a question and not as a statement in the written submission, because I think if you've listened to Honourable Hogan and even some of the colleagues sitting beside me, there are differing practices the world over when it comes to the role of parliaments to amending money bills. Clearly, some of them are enshrined through legal provisions for acts that provide for fiscal prudence, so that issues of the balance of power of Parliament over the executive is managed so that there's a no unhealthy tension that exists. It's also informed by who ultimately should be setting these frameworks for such fiscal prudence. Is it the legislature in its oversight of the executive, or is it the executive in its handling of the coffers of the state? So there clearly are differing practices, and in the submission, all we tried to do was to alert the committee to giving consideration and thought to this issue, because clearly we've had a very good turnaround of the finances of the state over the last 14 years, a very good outlook for the economy generally, a lot of which has got to do with the way the budget has been managed at different levels. So all we tried to do was to put the issue to say, going forward in dealing with amendments of money bills, clearly this must be something that must be top of mind. There's got to be a well-coordinated approach. It's got to be informed by clear guidelines, clear protocols, whether that is a percentage that relates to the changes that can take place in relation to the overall volume or the aggregates, as IDASA refers to, or whether they are informed through further legislation, such as that which was mentioned in New Zealand. I think, you know, one can have a long debate on it, but the issue of how far up and down can you move clearly must apply. There's got to be some measure for that type of fiscal prudence in dealing with something with this type of magnitude. The second question, I think, was from Honorable Hogan, and she posed two questions, which again I want to try and deal with both. The one was with regards to the role of the Financial and Fiscal Commission, and the other one was with regards to the whole issue of perhaps the notion of beginning to relegate the role of the NCOP. I think if you go to the section in the written submission where we begin to talk about the institutional memory, as well as very early on in our written submission where we begin to just contextualize our view of the way this Parliament has dealt with the budget process, I think what we're saying up front is that there actually are many good practices. Whether they reside through the work of this committee together with the work of the Standing Committee on Finance and the Joint Budget Committee or other organs like the FFC, there have been good practices over the last 12 years within the realm of this House when it has come to issues of budget transparency and the way in which the budget has been favorably disposed to taking input from the broader public. Clearly, there's room for continuous improvement. I think everyone will agree on that. And all we are saying is, let's look at those good practices. I think this is an opportune time to do that. Let's, in taking the legislation forward, also draw on the best of what has been in place, combined with whatever new measures is going to enhance the intent of achieving the objectives of this legislation. So my view, certainly where institutional mechanisms like the FFC, like the role of NEDLAC, can enhance what the intention behind this legislation is, and those instruments must be used. The issue of the NCOP, I agree with the Honourable Hogan, is something that you shouldn't be taking lightly. If you look at one of the first questions we posed in our main point of departure was actually related to the whole issue of the implications of this legislation on provincial and local government. So I think how one contextualizes the role of the existing Joint Budget Committee, which I think the colleague from IDASA also raised, again, there are institutional mechanisms in place which do work. And I think the challenge with this legislation is how do we basically draw on the best of what is in place, enhance that further, and look at the new mechanisms that need to be introduced. I agree that the legislation is actually silent on issues of the impacts on provincial and local government, and I think there needs to be more careful consideration. I think when I sat, and I'm not throwing the ball back, but when I sat and listened to the committee when they got their first briefing on the bill, it was one of the glaring areas that stood out to me, that this is something that needs to be dealt with. We have a very intricate system of intergovernmental, not just cooperation, but fiscal transfers in this country, and the role of the NCOP as part of the overall institutional architecture must be very clearly stipulated in this legislation. I think what I want to suggest is when it comes to the institutional mechanisms, the bigger picture is looked at in relation to also how one deals with issues of time constraints, planning constraints in terms of the legislature's own schedule, the work of existing committees, portfolio committees, for example, and government's own planning cycle. I think all of those considerations need to be looked at.
Okay.
I think, Chairperson, I think there was just one last question, and that was regards to the Honourable Marais, I think it was, he was referring to point 3.4 on page 3 of the submission.
Yeah.
What I was trying to say here was clearly the magnitude of the ability of Parliament to amend money bills. Through whatever procedure, it does that, as can have significant implications. And we think for both society at large, but for the constitutional role of this House and the mandate of government, is that there needs to be certain characteristics. This process must be very coherent. It must be predictable. You've got to be able to deal with issues of how you stagger and time the work of structures that are going to be introduced, the committees that have been spoken about. I think the People's Budget Coalition raised very similar issues. So we're trying to say that issues of certainty, issues of predictability is important, not just for the way this House will deal with implementation of this legislation, but also in terms of confidence in the public eye. The role of institutions that support our democracy, that uphold our democracy, are very important indicators for the outlook that people have for not just our economy, but our democracy itself. And we think that level of confidence and predictability is important. And we've coupled that with very real issues that relate to already heavy planning cycle that both government and the legislature has in its core functions. And we said trying to minimize unintended negative consequences that may arise from not doing this in a very coherent way needs to be given due consideration. I think IDASA again raised similar concerns about overburden on the legislature in this type of implementation. So our point of departure basically resonates with that type of notion.
Okay, in the remaining few minutes, can we also get now the BPC?
Thanks, Chairperson. I just wanted to make a response on the fiscal policy question raised by Honourable Hoggy. I think our submission doesn't actually need or require a straitjacket fiscal policy that may also run a danger of undermining mandates of government as they come and go, assuming we will continuously have a democratic process. I think the history of the People's Budget is also one of a critique of existing fiscal policy or fiscal framework, and which makes us to think that what is entailed in this draft bill is an assumption that there's a consensus on the fiscal framework when it's not. So our view is not really to what was pointing at saying, let there be a definition in the bill so that we can understand what we're talking about, because we're assuming a fiscal policy is part of a mandate that must continuously be sought, as with the range of other issues from the electorate, rather than a straitjacket convergence across borders, which is problematic in itself. The second point relates to, and of course the issue of the fiscal FSC, it's a very difficult question. One would appreciate that, but one would think it will play a more significant role prior to the tabling of budget, and it may not necessarily be in all money bills that they are relevant in terms of their role, but I think it needs to be pursued, and we should acknowledge to that. The NEDLAC, currently we do have the Public Finance and Monetary Policy Chamber, which of all the chambers of NEDLAC has been the one that has never had any impact in influencing policy, largely also because the Parliament itself was not able to influence money bills. And it was also not enjoying that much of participation from the Treasurer. And we think that it could now play a more significant role with this bill unlocking the process for for further democratization, because we must remember NEDLAC is a statutory body. It's not an out there organization of a nature such as civil society organizations. And so, yeah, coming to that question of raising expectations of people, we, of course, I mean, if the South African Council of Churches, the Congress of South African Trade Unions and Civil Society, we represent many people in our own right, and expectations ought to be high, so that when people are in government, are always to think about them as a reference of whether we're doing badly or doing well. But I mean, it's not necessarily these are false. These are realistic, informed by realities in which people live, and the democratic process requires that even when you amend many bills, that informs you. But that's not to say you ignore the frameworks, the important financial considerations. So I mean, we're not here demanding everything. We've always consistently tabled as a people's budget our proposals with some sound submission proposals on them. I think I'll end there.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Just very briefly, on the comment about the Fiscal Responsibility Act of New Zealand as being an interesting instance, I agree. I think what we're saying is that there needs to be a little bit more discussion, and then the legislation needs to be clearer, without specifically saying from IDASA's side at this point that we have a specific position on the content of that, but that it's not articulated sufficiently. So I agree with you. On the NTBPS being quite thin, I agree as well with that, with Honourable Hogan's comments there. I think a kind of a beefed up NTBPS is probably, would probably be a useful way of approaching it, which is, as I read in the legislation, is largely what is being spoken of here as well. I think that in combination with the annual reports, the strategic plans, the other information that is released throughout the year should constitute a viable enough information base for Parliament in its engagement from an amendment perspective. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. That then brings us to the end of this first session. We're going to break for tea for 10 minutes. Reverend Familia?
Chair, just a question. We just to acknowledge that we've been working on the extreme crime constraints of the People's Budget Committee. In terms of the question on the NCOP, we had actually included a comment from our annexure. It's not in here. We see it's not been included. May we represent that to you, the comment from the People's Budget Committee in terms of how we use the involve the NCOP. And the second question, sir, would be related to a question that's been raised out of here, is that we understand is that in terms of timeframes and committees and proposals, further details that we still would want to work on, could we have a second bite at the cherry and produce further
what are you trying to do? Okay, but do submit that in writing for the committee's attention. But if it could be during the course of this week, because the committee will then have to, when we deliberate, we would have to have all the information before us. We would appreciate that. In fact, I shouldn't be allowing you to do that, because even your submission actually came this morning, and it helps the committee to get this in advance, so that by the time we come to the committee, you also don't have to go through the whole submission reading it through, because if we had it in advance, you actually just talk to some of the salient points, and it helps the process if we get it in advance. But do submit that in writing. And, yeah. Okay. Let's break for tea.
10 minutes, please.